BCFM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The dreaded smart meters. Rumours are the energy companies will be able to cut off your power from 1,000 miles away. Yes, smart meters are beginning to replace those old electricity meters. So what's the truth behind them? Brighton-based Stop Smart Meters campaigner here, as well as our own homegrown Bristol Energy, to discuss them. The National Union of Teachers have just had their annual conference, passed a vote of no confidence in the Education Secretary Michael Gove. The usual lefty sour grapes, or do teachers have real worries about what's happening at the coalface of educating our children? Plus, postponed from last week, why do we never see or hear Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's British wife, Asma, on the BBC News? Is she an angel or a demon or somewhere in between? Make up your own mind when we hear In the Raw and unedited tonight. Plus, Martin Summers takes us via Korea on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. And Korea is where we're going to start tonight, Martin. There's a lot of saber rattling, or is there any real possibility that the North Koreans would commit harakiri and attack the United States?
Well, the worry has got to be that miscalculation will lead to a disaster for all concerned. It's very hard to read a situation like this, but we're not being presented with a fair assessment of what's happening. Don't forget, the South Koreans and the Americans have been carrying out very aggressive war games directed at the North
Koreans. What do you mean by that, a very aggressive war game?
Well, they flew a B-1 stealth bomber over South Korea recently, so they've been...
Well, that's South Korea, that's not North Korea.
Yes, I know, but the point is that the North Koreans perceive all of that as directed at them. And, of course, there's further complications. There could be sort of kind of internal power struggle in North Korea. What's very interesting, the North Koreans have both exploded both a uranium and a plutonium bomb. Now, that's very odd, because the Pakistanis...
But how recently was that?
Well, the bombs that they've exploded, I think they've exploded two so far, haven't they?
OK, one was the last few years.
Yes, one was a uranium-based bomb and one was a plutonium-based bomb. Now, you wouldn't expect that. You'd expect them to either have a uranium-based system for producing bombs or a plutonium-based system for producing bombs. But there is stuff out there on the internet, and people can find this in Veterans Today if they check Gordon Duff's stuff, Gordon Duff, D-U-F-F, or Peter Eyre, A-Y-R-E. That in actual fact, it may be possible that the North Koreans have got hold of their nuclear weapons from ex-NATO stock, in other words, USAF weaponry, the plutonium bombs, and ex-South African nuclear weapons, i.e. the uranium bombs, and that the British Conservative Party leadership were involved in buying and selling these weapons on the black market and lost them because they were dealing with a chap called John Bradenkamp and another chap called Billy Reutenbach, who were ex-Rhodesian SAS arms dealers.
Now, so are you suggesting that possibly what they're threatening the US with are nuclear weapons they got on the black market?
Yeah, but they're originally United States Air Force weapons which were dropped in the sea off Somalia in 1991. Now, this is all... if people are interested in this, they should research it by looking up the journalists that I have mentioned. Veterans Today, Gordon Duff, Peter Eyre, E-Y-R-E, his website covers all of this. They're all getting information from the same sources I'm getting information from, who doesn't want to be named. But in actual fact, it's quite possible that the North Koreans have got hold of these weapons from United States Air Force stocks and the uranium bombs from the South Africans via... Astra Holdings, which was a holding company set up by top Tory politicians in Britain to buy and sell nuclear weapons on the black market for personal profit. That is what we're being told.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
over to the Congo now, and MI6 and the death of Patrice Lumumba. This is an article by Gordon Carrera, the security correspondent for BBC News. A member of the House of Lords, Lord Lee, has written to the London Review of Books saying that shortly before she died, fellow peer and former MI6 officer Daphne Park told him Britain had been involved in the death of Patrice Lumumba, the elected leader of the Congo in 1961. When he asked her whether MI6 might have had something to do with it, he recalls her saying, "We did. I organised it."
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's all these years ago, and they feel it's okay to admit that they
did it. That's 52 years ago, isn't it?
It's been pretty well known all along that the Western Intelligence Services were involved in the assassination of Lumumba, so it's hardly a big secret, but they now feel it's okay to...
But they've actually admitted it. Daphne Park was the MI6 officer in charge of the Congo at a crucial point in the country's history. She arrived just before the Congo received independence from Belgium in the middle of 1960. Well, I mean, the way this is painted, it looks as if there was never really any intention for the European powers allowing the Congo to have independence, even though it was granted in 1960.
Well, exactly, and of course the removal of Lumumba then led to a takeover by Mobutu Sese Seko, who was the biggest bully in Africa for many, many years, far bigger bully than Robert Mugabe, but he was our bully, so that was fine. And of course Congo is still in an absolute state as a country. War rages, it's got the worst human development indexes in the world. I mean, a lot of other stuff in people's mobile phones is mined there by under incredibly horrible conditions. Basically, there's a lot for Britain to be shamed about in relation to its business in the past.
I mean, what does this tell us about MI6? It doesn't seem as if it's a very accountable organisation if it's going around organising assassinations of foreign leaders, people who've been democratically elected.
Well, yes. What do you think these intelligence services are there for?
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Finally, 1 million died from the Afghan heroin drug production, 40 times higher since NATO moved into Afghanistan. Heroin production in Afghanistan has increased 40 times since NATO began its war on terror in 2001, the head of Russia's Federal Drug Control Service has stated, adding that more than 1 million people have died from Afghan heroin since then. It's killed more than 1 million people worldwide since Operation Enduring Freedom began, and over $1 trillion has been invested into transnational organised crime from drug sales, Viktor Ivanov said at the conference on the drug situation in Afghanistan. He also produced a map, which we've got a little copy of here, Martin, looking at Afghanistan. 820 tonnes of heroin annually now coming out of Afghanistan, and this compares with 994 tonnes of cocaine coming out of South America. But, I mean, what does this tell us about who is really behind the international drugs trade?
Well, if people are interested in that, they should check a website out called ciadrugs.com, or there's another very interesting website called Narco News. Now, most of the political forces in Latin America across the political spectrum are very well aware of the Western Intelligence Service's involvement in drug trafficking as a means of financing their proxies. And this, of course, started in the 1980s in Afghanistan when the SAS were training the Mujahideen, and the Mujahideen were being funded by heroin, which was being brought to Britain, to Bristol, and people were becoming addicted to heroin, and it was a price worth paying to defeat Russian imperialism in Afghanistan at the time. And of course the Russians are still fed up with it, because they carry on doing the same things even now. I mean, it's beyond any kind of doubt that Western intelligence services, including MI6, are involved in drug dealing. Meanwhile, we arrest teenagers for smoking joints. Ridiculous.
Well, what's the point of it, though? What is the point of all this?
The purpose of it is that they got into it in the 1940s initially because they were losing the civil war in China. That is to say, the nationalists were losing the civil war in China against the communists. The security forces chiefs in the US went to the Congress and said, "We need a load of money to supply the nationalists with weaponry," and the Congress quite rightly said, "Well, we don't want to get involved in a civil war in China, we're not going to provide the money." So the CIA then racked their brains and said, how can we fund them? I know how we'll fund them. We'll set up a situation where they can bring drugs into the United States, make money on it, and then on the back of that they can fund themselves. And of course the same was done with the Contras in Nicaragua, and eventually the CIA ended up in a situation where it is today, where they don't know if they're an intelligence organization that does a bit of drug dealing on the side, or a drugs organization with a bit of intelligence that's gotten thrown in. And this is actually all documented. The UN report on drugs and crime, which came out in 2009, I've got a copy of it, and it pointed out that the banking system was bailed out by the drug cartels and the CIA at that stage. And that is well known amongst senior police officers all over the world. It's just not what you find on the front of the Daily Mail, is it?
And maybe not what you'll see in the new revamped national curriculum.
Drive Time on BCFM
93.2. And I'm joined by Anne Lemon, who's on the National Executive of the National Union of Teachers now. She's a teacher in Clevedon, teaching 12 to 18-year-olds science, as well as giving up her Easter break to go and be part of her national conference for her union. Hi, Anne. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi. Could I just start by saying hello to all my students who at this very moment will be studying very hard for their GCSEs and A-levels.
Now, I did sort of tongue-in-cheek, flippantly talk about the national curriculum, but I know it was a big point at your conference last weekend. Could you just tell us what changes are going on at the moment?
Yeah, it's a real issue for us. I mean, if you talk to a lot of parents of primary school age children, they'll tell you how much the children enjoy school. You know, they come home from school and they're happy, they're learning maths, they're learning literature, but they're actually enjoying the experience. And what we're very concerned about is that Michael Gove, with no real consultation with teachers, researchers or academics, is basically ripping up our curriculum in the primary sector and going back to the Dickensian period, where children will have to recite large amounts of facts and figures without any real understanding.
Well, isn't the problem that a lot of the children nowadays are coming out of school without those facts? I mean, they've got to be gotten into the children somehow.
But it's how children can come out with facts, but it's facts that they can actually apply. There's no point in having a lot of information if you can't apply it in the real world. And children will assimilate and take on information if they're taught it in a stimulating manner and in a way that makes it very real for them. I mean, history is a classic example. They want us to go back to teaching five-year-olds about Stone Age man, and then everyone else later on just the names of kings and queens of this island, and that's not how to teach history.
I mean, just tell us on the coalface, when you're teaching science, to what extent are you given flexibility and freedom to teach the way you want to teach?
Well, I've been teaching a very long time, and when I started teaching there was a lot of flexibility to be very creative and to try to get children to be problem solvers and to have think creatively and critically. And we had a very stringent national curriculum imposed on us, and that took quite a lot of those freedoms away.
So when was that then?
That would be in about 1992-93. And I think what's happened over the last 10 years has been an awareness that we need to try and get back to allowing children to problem solve, to work as teams, to start to think. And I think there's been real innovation in a lot of our schools in the curriculum, particularly in areas of maths, science and English, to do that. And we're just very worried that Michael Gove is attempting to basically destroy the curriculum without taking on any advice from those people that actually understand it.
But I mean, isn't surely what you're saying is actually a bit politically motivated? You're actually against the politics of Michael Gove. What he's trying to do, playing devil's advocate here, if I can, is he's trying to make sure that all the basics are covered, all those basics are covered, and that, you know, you can tick those boxes at the end of the year and say, the kids have got these facts, the most important facts.
Well, you see, those people that are really experienced that and that have worked for many years about how children learn and looking at ways that children learn would disagree with that. And you can teach people the same facts over and over and over again, and if they're not motivated and if it's not taught in a way that relates to them, then those children won't take on those facts. I mean, we're going right back to that Dickensian ideology of children sitting in rows, not participating and not thinking and just chanting.
Okay, what about the other types of schools, the free schools and the academy schools? Is the where does the national curriculum actually apply? Which schools does it apply to and which doesn't?
Well, it doesn't apply at all to free schools and to academies, and that's a real worry for us because, I mean, anybody at all could set up a free school. I mean, I think one of the Chuckle Brothers set up a free school. Anybody who's got an axe to grind, who's maybe some sort of religious maniac, can set up a free school and teach creationism, and that actually happens. So there's no quality of control, there's no accountability in free schools and academy. They're basically allowed to do exactly what they want, a real worry for us.
Well, don't you agree with the idea of teaching? I mean, you're talking about, you know, bringing along inquiring minds. Surely, you know, if you think that that, then you should be teaching the evolution and creationism and letting young people decide what they think.
I wouldn't have a problem with that at all, but I would have a problem if you're only teaching creationism, and which is what these schools are actually doing. And I think the picture's much bigger than that. I think this is only the beginning. What we're actually seeing is this government, not just Michael Gove, but this government are producing a package of schools which make them very acceptable and very desirable by the private sector to take over and run our schools. Just in the same way we've seen the beginnings of privatisation of the NHS, we're seeing schools being loosened up in terms of teachers' paying conditions, in terms of the curriculum, so that they can actually be taken over and run by large companies who will be able to make a profit from them.
So we're in an academy school here, we're at Bristol City Academy where the BCFM studios are. What is an academy school? What makes it different to a normal state school?
I mean, this is a lovely school and it's a really successful school, but the problem is it could still be a successful and a great school if it was under the local authority control. And the difference is that if you're under local authority control and something goes wrong in the school, or something that parents don't like, or there's a direction taken that people want to criticise, then you have got accountability with councillors that you actually elect. In an academy, there is no accountability at all, and that's a real fear about it, that once there's no accountability, what can parents do?
Can you see, though, with free schools, that there is a point to allowing schools to sort of go off in their own direction and then let parents and children decide which schools they want to go to? That actually this what it's doing is it's actually increasing the diversity of different options which are available to children and to parents.
Well, actually, what it's not doing is it's decreasing the resources that are available to all children, because those free schools, the money to set them up doesn't come magically from somewhere else. It comes from the pot of money that's used for all schools. And actually, this year, the academy and the free school programme is £1 billion in debt. So they've overspent by £1 billion. And that money comes out of the Education for All Children. What we want to see is a good school that parents are involved in, that there's accountability for all children, and there can be diversity within those schools. That's brilliant. But what we don't want to see is schools set one against the other and there being no accountability.
Now, let's just forget for a moment the infrastructure of schools, because everybody knows that many schools are not being repaired properly, that they're being allowed to crumble in some places. Just looking at your union and the way you're campaigning for changes in the way, or even maybe just to keep things as the way they are, what are the main thrusts of the union's campaigning at the moment? What are you actually campaigning for?
Well, we're trying to campaign to make sure that the curriculum isn't destroyed by Michael Gove.
Right, so you just want it to stay as it is it?
No, well, the curriculum is always changing. There's always innovations, but they've got to be innovations that are driven for the benefits of education by those people who understand how children learn, not by ministers that don't pay any attention to what's being told to them. I think secondly, and one of a real fear for us, is the dismantling of the teachers' pay structure. There's a proposal on the table which is going to mean that the teachers' pay structure will be completely written up, and it will be individual schools paying as much or as little as they want to different teachers. And we don't think that's the best way to attract bright young graduates into the profession. At the moment, we lose 50% of newly qualified teachers within the first 5 years. Mostly down to workload, some down to finance. If this goes through, we're going to lose an awful lot more. We're not going to attract those bright graduates that we need to keep into our classrooms.
Can you give us an idea of the pay scales of teachers right now?
A young teacher starts at £20,000. And there's an incremental rise of £700-£800 per year. But that only happens for the first 5 years. But that has been something that will allow young teachers to stay in the classroom. And what we're seeing now is the decision of whether or not you actually do get that incremental pay rise is being decided by individual head teachers, not by collective bargaining. And again, that's a real concern for us.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I know your father was a head teacher, wasn't he?
He wasn't.
And you do take quite an interest in all of this. It does seem from what Anne is saying that there's a slow sort of leeching away of pupils, children from the state and local authority control to other types of schools. Of course, this is going to make it a little bit more difficult to keep a handle on, but I mean, you've got to balance this, haven't you, with the freedom of different schools and different head teachers to teach children in different ways.
Well, as been pointed out, there's no reason why you can't have innovation, but you shouldn't be setting schools against each other. When my father took early retirement from the teaching profession in the late 1980s because of this whole business of making schools independent cost units so that if one school was more popular, then the money would move with the children. Now, my father didn't particularly agree with that. He said it's not actually a very effective way to spend your money. But what you could do is have each individual school is an individual unit, but you can go to the popular school and have 30 kids in the class, or the unpopular school and have 15. And at that point, gradually, the schools, all schools should be of a basic standard. But what's actually happened with the money following the pupils is that in actual fact you get successful schools and sink schools, and of course ultimately you get a situation where you've got a postcode lottery of what you end up with, and there isn't actually, it isn't even possible to have everybody to have choices. It's illusionary, and basically I think what's actually happened is that teachers, I mean, I'm sure Anne will agree with me, are very dedicated to what they do. It's actually a vocation rather than a job. And they just feel that the people in charge do not listen, do not care, and do not understand how the system actually works. So, for example, many of the people in charge have been privately educated. So the fact that Westminster competes with Eton, competes with Charterhouse, it seems absolutely normal to them. But in actual fact, what you want in a state-run system is for all schools to be of a standard, and for example for resources to be shared between schools. Why not? That's called cooperation, and that is actually how it should be run.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. I mean, this is a real fear. So we're beginning to see the start of privatisation. And if what Michael Gove said happens, that they allow academies to make a profit, then even starter academies, conversion academies, where you might have an individual head taking over an academy, very quickly we'll start to see big companies coming in, taking over large groups of primary and secondary schools and running them for profit. And we need to protect our young people. Education is not a privilege. Education's a right, and it should not be used to make profit.
But what's wrong with the idea of a school making a profit?
Because they make the profit at the expense of the children. If you make a profit, it means that you're not paying the teachers as well, therefore you're not employing or attracting the best calibre of teachers. If you make a profit, it's because your class sizes are bigger, so therefore you employ less teachers, or you have less support teachers. Support teachers are very important in schools, or you have less facilities. There's only a specific pot of money, and once you start taking profits out of that, then the people that lose are the children.
I know you've got some event coming up in May. I can see your leaflet there, something about May Day. What's that?
Yeah, I just want to say this is, I mean, it's not just teachers and that are being hit by austerity and are struggling because of pay freezes and pay cuts. There are lots of people out there, and people on benefits are being attacked. And we think there's a real opportunity for the people of Bristol on May the 4th to come out and show their anger about the bedroom tax as well. That's a big one. So I'd like people to come along on Saturday the 4th of May, College Green, at 11 o'clock with your banners and your placards and your anger to show this government that we are not going to put up with this austerity.
That sounds a lot like that morale question we were hearing about earlier on. It is all very important to keep up people's morale in these sorts of times. Anyway, Anne Lemon, National Executive from the National Union of Teachers, teacher yourself in Clevedon, 12 to 18 year olds. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, it's the modern way to measure how much electricity we use. It's called a smart meter. No need for a meter reader anymore. He can go on the dole and find one of those six, or join the 6.5 million people who are looking for another full-time job. Because smart meters use microwaves, rather like mobile phones. At least that's what we're told. To read your meter, it can even cut you off from a remote computer screen. Now, these are some of the myths and legends about these smart meters, but I'm joined to discuss some of this with two people. David Saunders from Bristol Power. Hi, David.
Hi, Tony.
And also Mike Mitchum from Stop Smart Meters. Hi, Mike.
Hi there, Tony.
Now, you are kind of on opposite sides of the fence here, because I know, David, you actually think that these smart meters are going to actually could change things for the better. Can you just tell us a little bit about what is a smart meter, first of all?
Well, a smart meter, at the moment you've got an electricity meter, which is just measuring the amount of electricity you use in your home. A smart meter is designed to be tied into your appliances. And for instance, if you've got solar power on your roof, it will also measure how much electricity you've generated, how much you've exported, as well as what's coming in. That's the bit I think's good, but I think that the campaign against smart meters have actually got some sound points as well.
Okay, what about this summit? Can you maybe blow away some of these myths? Can the electricity companies actually cut us off remotely? I mean, because what it's basically doing is it's getting rid of the guy that comes around or the woman to read our meter, isn't it?
Yeah, you're often not at home, so I don't have a problem with automation of it. It's the use of it, isn't it, really? The meter is a neutral piece of technology, actually, and it's a question of how you use it, whether it's serving some sort of insidious conspiracy agenda, or maybe stupidity agenda, or whether it really can be smart. And what we're trying to do is work out a community use for smart meters that's intelligent.
Okay, now what is Bristol Power? Because that's who you're representing.
Okay, Bristol Power Cooperative, and we are a starting up co-op of roof owners who've got solar on their roofs. So we've a couple of years ago there were a lot of people joining up with free solar schemes. The feed-in tariffs that pay for it dropped a lot, but we're running a cooperative that still puts free solar panels on people's roofs. We've done a very small install in an area of town where there's significant fuel poverty, and this year we're looking to scale up. And we actually use a kind of smart meter, actually one that uses Wi-Fi rather than microwaves, to track what's going on with the meters on the, with the generators on the roof, with the solar panels on your roof.
Okay, and your use of these, how did you decide to use them, or is it just, you know, one of the things that, because when you emailed me about this subject, one of the things I found fascinating is you actually said, well, smart meters could be used in a way to undermine the power of these big energy companies. Well, so how's that?
Well, first of all, if you look at the government's energy policy at the moment, it's that we're going to get our energy in the future from nuclear fuel, from fracking, which is getting gas out of the ground, shale deposits, from offshore wind, and what's the last one? Biomass, burning wood chip at Drax. And we're saying you could get solar from your own roof. Now, if you've got solar panels on your own roof, you know, guess who you pay for that? You don't. It's your own solar panels. And solar panels used to be expensive. They've got a lot cheaper in the last few
years. Hang on a minute. I mean, we've had Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth in here explaining how Friends of the Earth have been campaigning to actually keep the tariffs the same, and that the government have knocked them back. So they're actually more expensive over the last couple of years since the coalition government came in than they were under the Labour government.
Yeah, all true. Absolutely right. But the feed-in tariff used to be three per kilowatt hour, per unit of electricity that you use. It used to be 40 pence, and you would pay 12 pence for your electricity normally. So it wasn't really sustainable. The feed-in tariff is getting less and less. At the same time as the feed-in tariff was halved, the cost of installing solar panels also halved. At the beginning of 2011, it might cost £12,000 for a few kilowatts of solar on your roof. Now you can get that for £4,000 or £5,000.
Well, we're also joined, as I said, by Mike Mitchum from Stop Smart Meters. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks, Tony.
Give us a basic introduction to this. Why did you decide to get involved and help start a campaign against smart meters?
In a nutshell, I learned about smart meters, what they do, how they work, and what kind of dangers they represent, and then I was horrified to learn that nobody else knew about them as far as I could see.
So just to give us some of the basics, how do these things work?
They replace your analog electricity and gas meter, and they also have smart water meters as well that are coming in too. They're designed to communicate your use of utilities back to your utility provider, in some cases in near real time. As David alluded to, it operates as part of a home area network, so it's able to determine what appliances you're using and when, in what kind of manner, and communicate that information, which is very sensitive personal information, back to the utility company. It also provides the avenue for utility companies to begin the slow, gradualistic process of controlling your energy use.
What about this? I mean, this thing I mentioned at the top was really about whether they can actually remotely switch off your electricity rather than, I mean, you used to have to send someone around to do that. Yep. Being disconnected was quite a big big deal. But
that's right.
But is it possible that they can
absolutely
do that with these ones?
Possible,
so someone
definitely
can sit on a computer screen, press a button, and just cut your electricity.
Not
off.
Just your utility provider or your energy provider, but anybody with the know-how who has an internet connection. This is basically putting our utility and energy supply onto the internet.
Okay, so how is it related to the internet, though? Is it, as David was saying, going through Wi-Fi?
Unfortunately, so, yeah. I mean, Wi-Fi, 3G, 4G, WiMAX,
right, and
etc.
And the microwave networks. Yeah,
you know,
okay.
They're all terms for the same environmental toxin, unfortunately. These are using pulsed microwaves. Many smart meters put out incredible amounts of pulses per day. One British Gas smart meter that we measured recently was pulsing 43,000 times per day. So, yeah, the smart meter is an internet-attached piece of network equipment that can be remotely disconnected.
Now, it's kind of sounds to me is like it's part of this kind of electro-smog that's increasingly coming in, particularly to our cities. I mean, a friend of mine, he actually, one of the reasons he cited for moving out into Somerset was there's too much electro-smog in Bristol. It's everywhere. Would you take that as a serious argument? I mean, the thing is, surely these wouldn't be allowed, these kind of 3G, 4G networks and the Wi-Fi networks too, if it wasn't safe.
That's not true, unfortunately. Our government is hiding behind a veil that was put forward by a private group known as the ICNIRP many years ago. Their standards are woefully inadequate. It effectively requires you to start cooking before they regard Wi-Fi or mobile phone signals as being unsafe. And if you regard cancer, leukemia, DNA damage, cell damage, blood-brain barrier leakage, endocrine dysfunction, melatonin process disruption, etc., as a problem, then yes, it is serious. It's very, very serious.
Okay. Certainly, I can see why people might not want one of these things, David, from what Mike's been saying there. David, though, can you just tell us what these things look like? How do you identify one? How do you know if you're an electricity company? And are they used for gas as well?
Yes.
Yeah, so if your utility company has come around and sneakily taken away your old-fashioned meter and put a smart meter in, what do they look like?
They'll typically be innocuous-looking digital meters that have antennas coming out of them. There's a number of different providers out there that manufacture them. If your meter has been changed within the last 1 or 2 years, then there is a good chance that it's a smart meter. There's more than a million now that have been deployed in the UK, but most people don't know about this program.
Okay, and do you have any choice in the matter?
Yes, you can refuse one point blank on whatever grounds you like.
And if you find that you've been had a smart meter put in without you wanting to, can you get it changed?
That's a bit more difficult because your energy providers and utility providers are desperate for you to have one of these things in your house. That they are a solution to a different problem, and that's how to monetize further aspects of your life. You're not lawfully or legally obliged to have a smart meter, so refuse them. We have documents on our website, stopsmartmeters.org.uk, that you can download and send to your provider to decline any offers that they may put forward to give you a smart meter.
Now, David Saunders from Bristol Power, I mean, he's painted quite a scary picture there, particularly with the health. I mean, we all know that there are health risks with these Wi-Fi microwave technologies. But could you just really lay out for us the reasons why you actually think that these could be really helpful and useful, and particularly this business, which I don't think we really quite got to just now, about how it can actually undermine the power of these big energy companies? We've heard this week about this rather piddling fine, actually, for SSE, Scottish Southern Energy. You know, they are really taking the mickey. You know, what they're doing is they're defrauding electricity and energy users, and yet they're then paying tiny fines. I mean, something needs to be done to break up this oligopoly or this cartel of energy suppliers. And I think for many of us, you know, we'll think if we can install a smart meter and help break up that energy monopoly or cartel, we'd love to do it.
Yeah, and there may even be a best of both worlds, Tony. I don't disagree with any argument about pollution. I was an industrial chemist, and I know about the industrial chemicals in our foods, and they contribute just as much to cancer as microwave radiation.
And what about this electro pollution argument, though?
Well, we're sitting here in a radio station, aren't we, Tony?
Well, the transmitter's over on the Barton Hill Flats, so you know you don't have to be too, you're not too close, and it's only about, I think, 2 watts or something,
yeah.
Tiny amount of electricity.
And you know, that one could.
And microwaves are more dangerous, aren't they, than radio waves?
And you can't see them. And anything you can't see and you can't control and you don't understand is scary. But if you... So let's look at the upside. What's the government imagining is going to happen? What's the energy companies imagining is going to happen with electricity in the future? The price is going to keep going up. They're talking about guaranteeing a high price of electricity for 40 years to nuclear power companies to persuade them to come and build new nuclear power stations. And I'm thinking, hang on a tick. If I put solar panels on a roof right now, with or without a feed-in tariff, I can afford to pay a lower price of electricity on the electricity that's coming off my roof. That's not all my electricity, but currently with a feed-in tariff, we're actually able to give people free electricity. And that means their overall fuel bill is cut by 30-40%. More if you're at home during the
but
day.
But I don't understand is, where do these smart meters come in? Isn't there another meter you can have that isn't a smart meter?
Yeah, or you could even have a DC house. You could have a house where you're generating electricity on your roof and charging batteries.
Okay, so it's low voltage, really, and you don't need the high voltage that is needed to take electricity over distances.
Yeah, I think, nearly all the stuff in your house now, your little LED lighting, your computers, they're all running off car battery technology, quite low voltages. You could have houses that are less and less oriented around. DC used to be a wonderful thing for transmitting electricity around the country for grids. But if you're making the electricity at home, you can actually think, imagine an energy future when Bristol will be generating all its own electricity. And Bristol is really serious about that. We're talking that the city has a goal to generate a gigawatt of solar power. That's as much as a nuclear power station at midday. And when you're doing that, hey, you don't even need to be connected to the grid. And I'm perfectly sure that we could, if we set our minds to it, put in forms of metering that are non-invasive, not dangerous. We're smart creatures, but we have to want to do it. But I think we're starting by actually disconnecting ourselves from this cartel of energy companies. What do they've been privatized. There's a limit to their monopoly. They're companies who have to increase their profits 8 or 10% a year. How are they going to do that? Putting energy prices up. What do we pay at the moment? We pay a multiple of the cost of producing the energy to consume it. What we're doing is saying, well, why don't you put the generator on your roof? Then you won't have to pay that multiple.
Well, I see you nodding there, Mike. What are these smart meters? How do they actually work?
Well, they communicate with appliances in your home, even if you don't have smart appliances yet.
See, yeah. I mean, I was under the impression that they would detect what kind of appliances were using electricity, but they communicate with things like your toaster? No.
Two transponders in a typical smart meter, one which communicates your usage back to your local cell tower and then the utility, and another transponder that communicates with your in-home devices and appliances. Even if you don't have a smart toaster, a smart fridge, a smart TV, that are on the market now, which do provide incredible levels of detail about things that you do and watch at home, it's able to determine from legacy appliances using digital signature processing.
What does that mean?
Well, even if it's not a smart appliance, each of your appliances have and devices have their own footprint for what kind of energy they use and how. So it's able to determine, for example, whether you're using the kettle, the oven, the toaster.
Oh, I see. So it could also almost sort of do some quick sums and say, well, you must have this and this and this switched on at the moment.
That's right. A group of ethical hackers in Germany 2 years ago showed that smart meter security is incredibly poor, and they were able to circumvent the security and show that smart meters are so smart they could determine what you're watching on television. And that's not even a smart TV. It's using variables such as ambient light, backlight to show whether, for example, you're watching a particular film.
Okay. Now, you said a little while ago they've got a little antenna on. Have they all got antennae on them?
I haven't seen them all, in fairness, Tony. My first recommended recommendation would be ask your utility provider whether you have a smart meter. If they squirm, try and avoid the question. There's a likelihood you have. Ask them if they emit radio waves or microwaves. And you could even look at hiring an EMF detector from healthyhouse.co.uk or emfields.org.uk. For a few pounds for a week, you could determine whether you have a high level of electrosmog in the house, particularly near your meter.
Okay, electrosmog. Yeah. So that would be what? Are you talking about Wi-Fi?
Well, in this case, we're talking about microwaves. So, yeah, Wi-Fi, your digital cordless phone, your DECT phone, is a very bad pollutant of microwave radiation in the home.
So this is the digital cordless phone. This is something which is a portable phone, isn't
That's
it?
Right.
So yeah. they don't work on radio waves. You're saying they work on microwaves?
Well, microwaves are part of the radio spectrum, so yeah. And
no, but hang on a minute, because you do have to make some sort of separation between microwaves and radio waves.
Yeah.
Radio waves, yes, they can be dangerous if you're very up close to a transmitter.
Yeah, that's right.
But microwaves are actually more dangerous.
Yes,
you know,
I would
it's
agree
a
with
step
that.
Up,
particularly the pulsed modulated frequencies. And as you mentioned, your antenna is many miles away from here.
Well, it's about a quarter of a mile away.
Right. Okay. But
on
you
top
don't
of the
have
flats
people,
over there.
It's not in somebody's front room or somebody's garage like a smart meter is. And what some studies have shown is that smart meters can expose people to between 140 and 800 times the radiation of a mobile phone. So, yeah, take into account the extreme number of pulses that these things put out each day, and also the actual amount of electromagnetic frequency that they emit, then they're very bad for your health.
David, would you concede here that actually maybe this is a technology too far, particularly as Mike was talking there about hacking? You know, for goodness sake, you've got people possibly able to hack into your smart meter remotely and discover whether you're at home or not, whether you're on holiday or not.
I what Mike said is really interesting, and I do worry about hackers. When you've got, it's possible to hack into a voting machine in the United States, yeah. Not even with an intelligent hacker, not even with a great one. I love that bit about being able to tell what program you're watching but it's quite Orwellian. Mm. And yes, I do find that scary. The bit I would like to mention is that Bristol City Council, bless them, have been thinking about municipal energy, because municipalities used to have their own energy companies, and that's much more answerable than an energy utility. When the energy companies were privatized, city councils weren't allowed to have energy again. Bristol actually took the lead in getting the right back to have a municipal energy company, and they've just hired a commercial manager to move the city in that direction. I think Bristol's the only city in the country to have European funding to set up a municipal energy company.
Well, that's smart, particularly smart in that, sorry to the pun with the smart meters, but it's a sensible thing to do, because I mean many local authorities around the country are switching off their lights, aren't they? They're switching off street lights, saying oh, we can't afford to pay the bill. Well, if it's your own business, of course you can afford to pay the bill.
Yep. And putting up LCD lights, which only use a fifth of the electricity, and you know, so you can have brighter streets without massive carbon emissions.
Now, your solar revolution is all very well if you've got a roof and if you own your own home. Many people are renting. They can't do that. They don't necessarily want to do that, because why should they put a solar panel on their roof if their landlord's going to kick them out in 2 or 3 months' time?
And that's let me try one on you. It's the concept of the solar allotment. It already exists in Holland. People living in flats can buy a bit of a solar farm and get the electricity from that. And there's absolutely no reason why we can't do that in Bristol. You take brownfield sites. Actually, solar works pretty well on fields. You can graze sheep, but not cows, on a solar farm. And
I think the thing is, many people, David, might be rather cross about you putting a solar farm on. I mean, our green space is very precious. I mean, we had the Gary Hopkins attempt to sell off the green spaces, whatever it was, 18 months ago. It was absolute uproar. Those are precious spaces. We can't be putting solar panels all over them, surely.
Well, I tend to agree with you. And here's the point. If you've got there is enough roof space in Bristol. Bristol has got the country's first solar map. You can go onto the council website, Google on Bristol Solar Map.
Or your own preferred search engine, not necessarily Google.
Yep. Sorry, that was horrible of me, wasn't it? Go onto your preferred search engine, look for Bristol Solar Map, plug in your postcode, kick in your address, and you will see whether your roof is coloured red or orange, which means good for solar, or not. But if we've got a municipal energy company and we've got Bristol Power Co-op, if your roof's not good for solar, the person next door's might be. And with room for 700 megawatts of solar on the roofs of Bristol, I'm completely convinced, well, let's put the solar on the roofs first, not on commercially owned solar farms ever. But if you're going to have solar farms, let's have that be for the people who haven't got a suitable roof. But actually, if you average it out over Bristol, there's a huge amount of electricity generating capacity on your roof. Some people say that solar doesn't look very pretty. I say that nuclear power stations don't look very pretty. And put a little bit of solar on your roof, have your own energy. Smashing.
Mike Mitchum, what about bills? Because that's at the end of the day what many of us are thinking about, particularly since, you know, generally speaking, people's pay, certainly benefits, are not going up, whereas the bills are going up at an incredible rate. And it seems as if there is actually no real control on them, especially when you hear news as we have from Ofgem this week. They seem to be the toothless wonder that even when there's, you know, fraud going on and criminal activity, they don't even put a penalty on, which is going to lower the share price of an organisation. Quite often, these organisations, when they're fined, the share price actually goes up because it's such a small fine.
Absolutely.
What about bills? How are smart meters affecting bills?
Like you say, £10.5 million fine for Scottish and Southern Energy this week. Another three investigations are currently underway. EDF with some of the other big six energy companies. EDF were fined £4.5 million last year. These organisations are profit-seeking enterprises. They care about one thing, and that is the bottom line and their profits. They are foaming at the mouth to get these smart meters into your houses, because as energy becomes more expensive, and also as we try to incorporate more renewables into the supply, they're seeking to monetize. As people seek to reduce their emissions, they're looking at introducing time of use billing and to retain their profitability.
So what does that mean? Time of use billing, what's that?
Well, what we're seeing is people being encouraged to, there's a pilot scheme underway in Plymouth currently that is encouraging people to do the washing when it's windy, for example, and effectively do things that they would typically do under their own steam at a given point in time during the day when their energy company say it's going to be cheapest to
do.
Well,
we've had that for years with sort of nighttime people being encouraged to do things in the evenings and nighttime, haven't we?
Yeah, but this is going a much bigger step further. A one-year study that I will mention in Toronto showed that after smart meters are installed, 80% of people's bills increased, often by more than 50%. That should tell. I had one person on the phone to me a couple of months ago who runs a business in London, and she was seeking desperate help because her smart meter that she'd been sold by her provider on the basis that it would save her money was in danger of putting her out of business. Her bill doubled.
Well, we've had this with a lot of these energy companies. Also, one of the other things that does concern me is that intelligence services, in fact, have been seeing these smart meters as a possible strategic threat
indeed
to the country. So, sorry, David, we're getting quite a lot of anti-smart meter arguments coming in here. But how on earth can a smart meter be a strategic threat to an entire country?
You have an energy supply and a utility supply that's effectively become web-enabled, part of the internet. So like I mentioned, you know, if your utility provider can cut you off remotely, a 10-year-old in China with the know-how can cut you off remotely. The former head of the CIA, James Wolseley, said that this isn't a smart grid, it's a stupid grid. And in all fairness to David, I think the efforts that he's made have been tremendously positive, and the direction that he's taking the rooftop revolution in is a good one, but there is a proverbial foreign object in the punch bowl here, in that this smart meter is not smart at all. We have GCHQ that have directly said smart metering will represent a strategic threat to the to UK households and put households in danger of hacking and terrorist attacks. There is an awful lot of rhetoric being built up around cyber attacks. There's effectively cyber warfare going on. We had Stuxnet, which was targeting the Iranian nuclear program, ostensibly developed by the US and Israel. What are the kind of worms and Trojan horses are out there? What kind of protections have our energy companies and utility providers put into the smart meters that they're promoting?
Well, that's a question for you, David. Do you know anything about that? Because this is a new one on me, the idea that actually at a sort of national national security level, certain individuals, the head of the CIA, we've just heard there, are saying, hang on a minute, this could be a strategic threat to the nation. Yeah. It could be a way of a foreign country hacking in and saying, hey, guys, we're going to close you down.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm really focused on the positive uses.
Okay. if you can find
It's what Winston Churchill said: the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And if a meter is smart, it's actually got a computer in it, and as soon as you detect a threat, I mean, on my computer, when a virus has been detected, the next version of the operating system has got something against that. I'm sure that will happen as well. You know, viruses happen, and you have defense mechanisms as well. The other thing I would mention about smart meters is that a web-enabled smart meter can do energy trading. So if I've got solar on my roof making electricity during the day, and oh damn, I'm not at home during the day, I could be selling that electricity to somebody else. But suppose my car is at home during the day because I've cycled to work. I charge up the car during the day. I get home in the evening. I tell my smartphone that I'm not going anywhere tomorrow. And my smartphone, working with my smart meter, says, hey, I've got a battery full of electricity. I'm going to sell it when the price is best. Because one of the things that will happen on smart meters is energy trading. And that's the possibility for everybody to become.
But don't we really want to be spending our time trading energy, do we? Surely what we want is a system we can install in our home that's just going to do it for us. It's going to provide us with electricity, and if we've got surplus, it's going to sell it for us.
I didn't say I was going to do the energy trading. No, the idea is that you get your children to download software from the
internet. Right, they can do it in playtime at school or something.
Young people will find the best software to do the energy trading and stuff like that. And what happens with, it's called micro generation and local markets. And the other word is the smart meters and the smart grids. A smart meter is, it is a dumb meter. It's measuring what's going on. It's connected to the things that are doing what's going on. But if you connect that to your own little bit of local intelligence, it could be your phone, it could be a tablet computer, it could be anything, it can start trading. And when it starts trading, what happens with the price of electricity is it starts going down. Bristol wants to be the country's first solar city, and that actually means the city, we hope, with the cheapest electricity in the country.
Okay, David, finally, can you just remind us where we can find Bristol Power on the internet, and also where we can find your, I mean, it sounded great, this idea that you can have a look from above and see whether your roof, if you've got one, yep, and you've got control of your roof, which a lot of people don't have, is suitable for solar.
Yeah, that's the Bristol Solar Map, which you can search for. It's on the council's website. The council put it together, quite enlightened, and it shows how much room there is for solar. And Bristol Power Co-op is at bristolpower.coop on the web. And the website is a bit wonky at the moment. It's going to be a lot better during the summer because we'll be expanding this year. Last year we were testing. This year we'll be putting more solar roofs in Lockleys, and later in the year we
hope. So you've got a site called streetsofsolar.org, haven't you?
But that's true too. And that's the point. If you were, suppose you were putting water around a city, you wouldn't think to do it one house at a time. You'd run a pipe up the centre of the street and then spur off to every house. And our idea is, it makes much more sense to put solar in a whole street. It costs less, and that means we can give more benefits to the users.
Okay.
So we're trying to sign people up whole streets at a time. And the campaign, streetsofsolar.org, is actually to share with anyone this idea that if you put one van full of installers can put solar on three roofs in a day.
Okay. Now, finally, Mike Mitchum, whereabouts can we find you online?
Stopsmartmeters.org.uk is our main website. Head there for more information. We've got loads and loads of studies that back
up. What about this World Health Organization? Let's just finish on that.
Well, the World Health Organization, a number of years ago, upgraded its classification of microwaves and electromagnetic frequencies to a class 2B carcinogen, joining companies such as DDT, methylmercury and lead. There is enough evidence to give them concern that this is a possible carcinogen, and there have been extensive calls for that to be upgraded further to a 2A carcinogen as well. When that happens, we're going to have to start rolling back these microwave technologies, and that, to my mind, couldn't happen soon enough.
Okay, well, David Saunders from Bristol Power and Mike Mitchum from Stop Smart Meters, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thanks, Tony.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, as promised, the wife of the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, Asma al-Assad, and we'll have a little chat with Martin when we've heard a bit from her, because we don't hear anything hardly from her at all. So what kind of person is she? You decide.
Over the past 10 years, two words have been reoccurring in our daily dialect: extremism and terrorism. And with these words, we hear a multitude of approaches as how best to deal with them. The military approach has proven to be a complete failure, and if anything, in my opinion, completely counterproductive to what we need to achieve. Some proponents of this approach have moved on to more enlightened forms of nation building, which includes education and development. But I'd like to argue that unless we include culture in what we're trying to achieve, I don't believe that we'll be able to build the future that we all aspire to.
That's Asma al-Assad. Just a little clip there, but old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We don't hear hardly anything from her, even though she's British, and at the heart of the Syrian regime. She does appear on press TV, but that's been banned by Ofcom, and also many of the Syrian channels have been banned by Eutelsat, which is a private business.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there is a big conflict going on in Syria, and we're being given a rather distorted view of it. It's, you know, we need to hear all sides, otherwise we can't make our mind up, can we?
So, I mean, what do you think would happen if it was more airtime given to Asma?
Well, I think what's happened is we've gradually realised that there's more than one narrative going on here. It's not just bad guys with white hats and good guys with blue hats or whatever it is. I mean, basically, it's complicated, and that's what people need to recognise.
Well, she seems to me a very sensible lady, and I think you should track her out on the internet, because we won't see her on the BBC. Anyway, time to sign off. All Live Typical Topical Afro Tropical Show is next. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for St George West, former leader of the Labour Group, Peter Hammond. Thanks also to Anne Lemon from the NUT, and to David Saunders and Mike Mitchum. Next week, BCFM Euro debate. Two very different MEPs debating the Euro crisis. Please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, British officials in North Korea have been told their safety cannot be guaranteed in the event of a conflict. The regime has made several threats to attack mainly South Korean and US targets and has apparently been repositioning its missiles, but the Foreign Office isn't planning to evacuate its embassy. Our Asia correspondent Mark Stone's near the demilitarized